where the next special issue of IEEE Software is going to be focused on the software engineering that goes into climate studies. And to help us understand a little bit of the domain in this very both interesting and important subfield of software engineering, I'm here today talking with Robert Jacob from Argonne National Laboratory. And he's going to introduce us to a number of some of the insider's views of what it means to be a developer in this domain. So, Robert, could I ask you to start just by introducing yourself briefly?
Sure. So my name is Rob Jacob, and I'm a computational climate scientist here at Argonne National Lab. I've been here about 10 years. I live in the Chicago area, and my background training is actually in atmospheric science. That's how I got interested in climate modeling. And I've been involved in the construction and design of climate models really for starting with my graduate school years for probably about 15 years now.
Great. Well, thank you. So as I was kind of pulling together the stuff for this particular special issue of IEEE Software, it was somewhat amusing to me that as I was looking through the Washington Post the other day, the whole idea of climate studies and global warming is back in the news again, and there's all this controversy about, you know, some of the folks running for president, and do they believe it? Do they think that it's, you know, not an established fact? And it's an amazement to me how much controversy is just perennially kind of surrounding this whole special topic. And so one of the first things I was thinking of was, does any of that kind of filter through to the people developing the code and doing the science? I mean, do people feel a bit that they're maybe not under attack, but that there's people out there kind of waiting for them to make a mistake or to find problems in what they're doing? Or does that really not kind of impinge on the day-to-day processes?
I would say for the day-to-day processes, no, it doesn't really impact very much. A lot of people in this field are aware that what we've been hearing is that we need to be able to communicate better. Mm-hmm. About the science and what goes into them, and I think that's true for the developers of the software as well. But certainly, a lot of the scientists who are publishing peer-reviewed papers on this topic feel a special need to be able to feeling pressure to talk more about what they do, basically.
Mm. So when you have this conversation about kind of what the latest results are showing in the climate studies, I was wondering, to what extent is the code part of that conversation even? I mean, do people in this field kind of put the code out there for other people to comment on, or do you just really publish the results of it and the code stays inside? I mean, how does it work? How does the code help build up the evidential background?
Well, the code, especially the climate model code, is used mostly to produce the results, and then it's the results that are published, usually in the form of figures. And what will typically happen is there'll be a reference in that paper to some technical description of the model that's maybe gray literature or something like that. Although some journals have been doing, there's been more and more software engineering journals coming around where you can actually publish details about the software, but this is an issue in the publishing of science that we've also been talking about. How do we tie the results that are in these papers, that are in these very dry kind of graphs and pictures, back to the code? It's not enough to just have a paper trail. Can we do this electronically? Can we actually link to a source code repository tag and things like that?
Mm-hmm. Have people thought about making some of the modeling code even open source for people to get access to, or is that something that people are already experimenting with?
Yeah, the code that I work on mostly, which is the Community Climate Model, now renamed the Community Earth System Model, is a completely open source code. You can there's a little registration process where they like want your email, but other than that, pretty much anybody can get a copy of the actual code.
Uh-huh.
Once you have that, you also need several gigabytes of data sets to run it and a lot of hardware, but you can get the code.
All right.
And, a lot of us do feel that because so many important decisions are being made based on what we know about the climate, and a lot of that comes from climate simulations, which are computer models, we do feel that these codes should be completely open for anybody to look at.
Wow. So How big are the teams that work on these things? I mean, is it a couple of scientists that would produce these, or is it large, you know, globally distributed teams? How big of a community goes into each of these?
I would say it's more large and globally distributed, or at least nationally distributed.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, every major country has kind of their own nationally developed model, usually headquartered at like the National Meteorological Center. The U.S. is kind of an exception. We have two major models, really three, split among various scientific agencies. And then the teams on each of those can number in the dozens.
Wow. Okay. So I hadn't realized that each country really had their own version of the. I guess they're all somewhat trying to do the same thing, right? But with different levels mm-hmm. of granularity, different factors maybe that come into the models.
Yeah, a lot of them make different choices in the numerical methods
mm-hmm.
and in how to implement those numerical methods in software. There's also decisions on what kind of physical processes to include
mm-hmm.
and how you set various parameters in those processes. So, yeah, all of these decisions result in models that are all slightly different from each other.
Oh, interesting. So I'm guessing then that there would be some sense of maybe friendly competition among all these different models.
Definitely, yeah. Everybody wants to be able to reproduce the known features of the climate better than anybody else.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And is there a sense of benchmarking? I mean, how do you know that one is doing better than another if they have two somewhat different results?
One of the ways that we benchmark is there's an internationally organized model intercomparison project where they define a set of experiments, for example, simulating the 20th century, and they define what forcing to use, and then all of the models do this simulation, and then they can compare the results because we know what happened in the 20th century, so we have a good we have a good idea of who got it right and who got it wrong.
Oh, interesting, interesting. And one of the things you mentioned was that the models make different decisions about, I think you said, how to handle some of the numerical analysis issues. Could you give, for those of us who are lay people and maybe not into all the details, but could you give somewhat of a layman's view on what that would mean, really?
Well, what it means in one case is how to represent the atmosphere and ocean as a fluid. They are theoretically treated as fluids, and so you have to basically do fluid dynamics. You have to solve fluid dynamics for the entire Earth, for the atmosphere and the ocean surrounding the entire Earth. And so that means you have to make a decision about how to represent those fluids, usually as a collection of grid points. Okay, now you have to decide, well, which collection of grid points and how are these grid points related? And there's different decisions. There's different ways to basically discretize the system. And then to apply a numerical method to that discretized system. I'll throw out some terminology here. Some people use the finite volume method. Some people use spectral element methods. These are all methods for solving the fluid equations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I guess the main result, or the main difference, I should say, would be that some of these methods will give you better better granularity or better fidelity in the answers to reality than others. Is that right?
Right, right. They all have different properties in terms of their stability and in terms of how much of the fluid motion they can capture. And then there's also trade-offs in how they can interact with the rest of the model, things like radiation transfer, which is not modeled as a fluid but has to be included.
Uh-huh. Okay. So one of the kind of subpoints that I wanted to bang on a little bit today was when we had emailed a little bit before this conversation, and you said that one of the things that you wish people knew more about in terms of the climate studies was that the code is really well tested. And I think that's one of the most interesting aspects of this whole area of work, because in many things that we're doing, I mean, we really have a sense of what we want the software to do when we're developing it, or at least we can get something to go in front of the customer, and the customer can tell us whether we got it right or not.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in so many of these cases, we're really trying to get an answer that we don't know already, and that's the whole reason we're doing the coding.
Right.
And so I was just really curious about how people do assure that the right answers are coming out or assure the quality of the results from the models. And one approach that you just said was benchmarking. Yeah, are there others? I guess, you know, looking back, applying the models and looking backwards and trying to come up with answers that we already know is, you know, and make sure that they're on target is clearly one approach. But are there other things that people do in terms of quality of the answers?
Yeah, there are some simpler kind of benchmark cases. There's very simple theoretical systems, like imagine an atmosphere with on a planet with just no mountains and no land surface, so it has a very simple flow, a flow that we can calculate analytically. Then if we know the analytic solution, we can use our numerical method and compare against that. There are all kinds of these simplified test cases that you can try running it against. That's again for the fluid part. For the more what we call the more process oriented parts of the model, things like how sunlight passes through the atmosphere, how convection happens, we can compare against detailed observations made at those scales. The experimental scientists in this field will make these incredibly coordinated efforts to go out and measure storm systems and things like features of the tropical Pacific that you have to deploy instruments over several hundred square miles in order to capture correctly. And we can look at those experimental determinations of how the atmosphere works to also compare parts of our model.
Okay, excellent. And is one of the strategies that you would use kind of a divide and conquer? I mean, is it possible to look at some of these some of the sub-technical domains individually and then try and put them all together later on and see where it goes from there?
Yes, yeah, so that's exactly what happens. So a lot of climate models, kind of a high-level view of a climate model is that it has four main pieces. There's an atmosphere part, ocean, a land, and a sea ice. And each one of those parts can be broken up and run individually where the forcing is prescribed. And then you can, and then domain experts can look at the results with kind of an ideal forcing and compare that against observations and against other measurements.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can break it down even further. Like you can take the atmospheric model and you can look at just the convection scheme or just the boundary layer scheme and compare those against measurements of those features.
And to what extent does all this so it sounds to me like what you're really doing is kind of building up an assurance case, and you're saying, well, we've applied all these different techniques, and we've looked at some of the submodels, and we've done some calibrations against benchmarks. Does that all get put together somewhere? I mean, is it ever published that you should believe our results because we've done X and Y and Z?
It is published, but I don't think there's like an aggregate. These comparisons are research projects that can occupy an individual scientist for years, and so they get published here and there. But I don't know if anyone's actually aggregated them all together and said what usually gets aggregated together is the comparison against the 20th century using the full climate model. But
right.
Basically, if you go through all the references for the model, you can find all of these cases.
Ah, okay. Because it does seem to me a lot of the skepticism at some level that I've heard comes from, at least the folks that I've been talking to, comes from this feeling that, well, these models are answering this big, crazy question, and you don't really know the underpinnings that go into it. But I think what you've just described is a very, I would say, a step-by-step and very incremental approach to building in the confidence of all the subpieces as you go after the big answers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very much how it happens. One of the difficulties is when you could test all of these pieces individually, but then when you put them together, they affect each other. And
mm-hmm.
so there's kind of this leap from testing the pieces to testing the full coupled model. That once you've assembled the full coupled model, you only have really the 20th century observations of the full climate system to compare against.
Mm-hmm.
So there is kind of a gap, I would say, in our testing, which is testing groups of software together, besides that, we do a pretty thorough job of building up the case to give confidence in the predictions.
Okay. So do people seem to be doing different types of things as people are worried about more communicating, I guess, some of the rigor that goes behind the models better? do people end up doing different types of development practices over time, or is it more a matter of how they describe the results, I guess?
I think it's more a matter of how to describe the results. I mean, so when you have, we already have a situation where when you have these loosely, these distributed development teams like spread over a country, just getting them to communicate and understand what's going on with each other is a challenge. And and so simply adopting enough practices for that, we feel will be enough for any outsider who wants to take a look at the code and what we're doing with it.
That's good. One of the things we had discussed on email before we started talking today was, you know, if there were practices that seem valuable in this environment that more people should know about or more people should be adopting. And I think the sense I had from the email description you had sent was that it's really nothing that's so sophisticated or out of the ordinary, but it's a real reliance on just generally good practices that most of us, I think, would already recognize. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot still to go in the opposite direction. You know, climate modeling was relatively late to adopt things like even bug tracking or issue tracking using that kind of software. So so bringing in those kind of practices from the rest of the community has been very helpful for the climate modeling area. Mm-hmm. You know, so for going the other way in climate modeling, we have to be very, very practical, and so we're always looking for what is just the right tool to do the job, because we don't want too much software to get in the way of the science. That's kind of that's kind of the feeling. At the end, these things are really giant scientific tools, and it's most important that they be able to do their job as scientific tools.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I remember thinking too when I was reading your emails that one of the watchwords might be looking for things that are well tested, even if they're not maybe the latest and greatest. And you mentioned that,
right.
I think a lot of these models rely on Fortran, which I know many people that I know would look a little bit askance at, perhaps. But I think from the scientific community's viewpoint, we've never really found a better replacement for some of the things that Fortran does for scientific computations.
That's right, because when you take all of the equations that describe the atmosphere, for example, you have all the fluid dynamics equations and then all the equations for the various radiation and convection processes, you get a whole lot of algebra. And really the most efficient way to convert that algebra into instructions for a computer is Fortran, or at least no one has found a better way of doing it. You hear this kind of snide comment that says you can write Fortran in any language, which means that people try to use a different language and it winds up looking like Fortran.
Exactly.
But the reason for that is that there's really so many ways to render algebra as ASCII. and those all wind up looking the same.
Good. So how do, when new scientists come on, is there a similar training that they go through? At least the teams that I've talked to, people come from all kinds of different scientific domains and maybe don't all have the same type of CS background. Is there a way that people bring them up to speed? Do they just find community norms over a while, or maybe it's not really as all nailed down as I've been thinking it might be?
Yeah, no, the training is really very haphazard. Everyone is kind of self-taught and just kind of learns the community standards, as you said. This has been an issue that has been discussed quite a bit in our community recently, which is how do we provide more training for software engineers who want to get into this field. As I'm sure you're aware, most computer science courses departments don't offer a Fortran course. and so it's things like that. We need to, there's this sense that the universities where most of our programmers and software engineers come from are really not stepping up to provide training for these people. And it's a lot of people see it as kind of a looming crisis, because as the hardware gets more complex, which is happening in the high-performance computing world, it's going to be even harder to program these machines, and yet we have fewer and fewer really resources to train people to use them.
Mm. That's an excellent question. So when you put these teams together, where some folks maybe have a little bit more CS background, other folks come from climate studies and fluid dynamics, how do you manage all those different areas of expertise on the team? I mean, do people have a hard time kind of communicating with each other coming from these different backgrounds?
I would say yes. I think that might be a problem initially. Probably the biggest learning curve is just understanding what is needed. This idea that it's the science that's the most important part. And once everyone kind of adopts that as their framework, it's more possible to work together, I think, towards the common goal.
And what would good university training look like? I mean, if the universities were to do it better and maybe have people come out with a little bit more of a common baseline, is it the parallel computing part of it? Is it more just software engineering basics? I mean, what would be the most important part, I guess, to add into that mix?
You would definitely need both of those. There would be some software engineering basics. How do you scope out a project? How do you choose your data type? How do you choose your implementation language? Understanding what compilers do, what optimization levels do to your code, and then understanding all of the aspects of parallel programming, including message passing, threading, and now we have to worry about GPUs too.
Oh, GPUs. That's an interesting.
Yeah.
So, are GPUs a major part of it? Do you have GPU networks that are kind of taking the place of some of the parallel supercomputers, or what role do they play there?
What we have is parallel supercomputers where the node in the computer is being augmented with a GPU.
Hmm.
So there will be this GPU alongside, or a few GPUs alongside a few CPUs, and it's up to the programmer to explicitly, move a calculation to that GPU and then move it back. And we're doing this because these GPUs are relatively inexpensive and provide a lot of floating point operations.
Mm-hmm.
So people are looking at how to use them more in their calculations, but the software stack gets really deep if you try to use those.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, would everyone on the team be worried about those type of things? I mean, really, how to exploit the parallel nature of the supercomputers, or do people kind of, how do I want to say, put those off into libraries or, I/O parts of the code, and the scientists do their part and the computer scientists do the parallel part? Is it clean like that, or how does it really get organized?
That's a pretty good top-level description, I think, of how things go. The scientists would, for the most part, not want to think about parallel programming. ideally, they could specify their algorithm, and of course, everyone wants the magic parallel compiler that just does everything for you. In reality, when you get down to the parallel implementation, it's usually a collaboration between numerical methods developers who kind of like applied math people and computer scientists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know that the hardware underneath you is changing all the time, and as you talked about putting GPUs into the mix too, I could imagine that creates a little bit of people running to catch up and use the best hardware. What is it that really drives the new functionalities that people are adding all the time? I mean, is it the advances in the hardware on the parallel side? Is it the advances in the libraries that help you use them? Or is it really just, if that stayed the same, people could be doing new science as they figure out new parts of the problem?
I think what drives the we are concerned about time to solution.
Mm-hmm.
There's kind of a minimum rule of thumb of you want to get about 5 simulated years per day out of your climate model.
Mm-hmm.
That's enough for a scientist to complete experiments in reasonable amounts of time and publish the results.
Mm-hmm.
So as the hardware has increased over the past few years in power, what happens is in the climate community is kind of anticipates that and says, okay, if the computer is going to be this much faster in this amount of time, then we can increase our resolution, say,
mm-hmm.
we can add more processes that we previously were ignoring or were holding fixed. And so the result is that as climate models are kind of evolving in terms of their complexity along with the hardware, so that even though computers are, you know, much faster than they were 10 years ago, climate models are still getting about 5 to 10 years per day.
Mm-hmm.
So we love it when the hardware community delivers something that's faster, and we will definitely take advantage of that. I like to think that a climate model can basically grow to consume all the available computational power that's around. But with the new trend, instead of increasing clock speed, you now have more cores and more heterogeneity. It's going to get harder and harder to realize more speed just by waiting.
Mm. We've been talking a lot about looking at the granularity of the model and trying to increase that granularity as the processor speed underneath this goes up. And it occurred to me this is probably a very naive question, but when you are looking at global climate, do you have a common level of granularity for the whole globe in a sense, or is it possible to, are there things that are more interesting and you can delve in there and put more granularity and keep the rest of the model at a higher level?
That's not a naive question. For the most part, you know, up until now, climate models have kept the granularity mostly constant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very simple, mostly because that's the simplest way to do it. And there are certainly features in the climate system where you want to add resolution or add granularity or add resolution. There's current systems in the ocean that hug the coastline, and so you would like to have more resolution there than in the interior of the ocean. And flows in the atmosphere get very complicated near mountain ranges, so you would like to have more resolution there. And so that's actually a current area of research is how to do that in both your algorithms and in your software. How can we add resolution kind of both as the model is going and also in physical places that we know need it?
Oh, excellent. Okay. So the last question I had, just something that really kind of stuck out to me when we were emailing the other day, was that you mentioned that one of the things you would like people to know about these things is that the physics behind the algorithms is mostly very basic 19th century stuff. And that really seemed like such a contradiction in a way to these sophisticated numerical analyses and the types of modeling that gets done and this idea of increasing the level of granularity as much as we can. What did you mean by that statement, and how does that come into play with the software?
Well, what I meant by that is a lot of people have a complete misnotion of climate models that it's some kind of statistical fitting exercise. Mm. But climate models are really at their heart, they're doing fluid dynamics, which is based on the Navier-Stokes equations, the same things that companies use to run simulations of aircraft wings or whatever. Now the equations have been adapted to be on a sphere and to describe oceanic and atmospheric flows, but it's all basic, very basic. That's what I meant by 19th century physics. And then the equations that describe the transfer of radiation through the atmosphere are basically Maxwell's equations. But the atmosphere and the ocean and the climate system are very when you start looking closer and closer, there's more and more processes that you can describe. You can describe the transfer of moisture through plants, because it turns out that's an important way that the surface cools itself, is through transpiration by leaves. So now you need some equations for that, but it's all still very, very simple physics at the heart of it.
Oh, interesting. That's really just a matter of kind of scaling it up to include more and more processes at higher and higher levels of detail. But I guess what you're saying is that the equations underneath it all are the same ones we've been using for 100 years or so.
Yeah, that's true. There are some things that we don't have, that the equations are basically very parametric. For example, one of the big sources of uncertainty is how we represent clouds. Now, we know very well how clouds operate on a microscale. that's, again, some very basic 19th century physics. But how do you represent the functions of a cloud over the coarse granularity of hundreds of kilometers? That's open to debate.
Interesting, interesting. Okay, excellent. Well, this was, I think we've kind of run around and hit a variety of different topics here, but hopefully from at least my point of view, this was a really interesting primer on how the climate studies get done in terms of the software development side, at least. And speaking personally, I think it's really answered a couple of the misconceptions I had about how people do this on the inside. Is there anything that we might have missed that you feel it's important to get out there?
Another thing I wanted to, there's one more thing I wanted to get out there, which goes back to the training. So there's two issues that this community is dealing with. There's the training, and then there's also the reward section. So most of this, most of the climate model development occurs in an academic community. Now, in an academic community, for years, the reward structure has been based on how many papers do you publish?
Yes.
So what we're trying to figure out how to do is how do we attract talented people into this field and give them and basically give them a career advancement and recognition for developing software, because that takes just as much time and just as much mental effort as writing a paper, and it's just as important to the whole enterprise. But we really don't have a good reward structure set up for that. So that's another thing that we're struggling with.
Very interesting. So do you have a sense of what would, assuming we could get all the kinks worked out, what would be the ideal? I mean, would you want to see the code being published the same way that papers are, or that there's repositories that are recognized and some are better than others because of the benchmarks that they've passed? I mean, is there a sense of, what is the piece that's important there? Is it really making the code visible? Is it just getting better and better results? How would you do that reward system?
Yeah, it's making the code visible. It's making a usage of the code more understandable. A lot of times, for people that do release the code gets downloaded and then we never hear from the users again, even though they may be using it to learn something, and the developers should get credit for that somehow. And so how to do that, I don't know, but. It's usage of the code that I think is key, because that's kind of like how much a published paper is referenced, which is a good measure of worth in the academic community. We want to know how much our code is used.
Oh, absolutely. Do people do things like blog about the code and who's using it? Is that something that people have started to do, or
not very much? I haven't seen very many blogs about the model code. We do, the CCSM model that I mentioned earlier maintains basically a message board, and you can go there and hear from users sometimes and get kind of a feel of how they're using it. I wouldn't say there are a lot of blogs or other things specifically devoted to climate code.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know that blogs are the right answer, but I think clearly what you're talking about is some kind of a two-way communication versus more of I publish it and now people can read it, one-way street type of thing.
Right. Right.
Well, excellent. Well, I think this is – it certainly sounds like the one thing we haven't really talked about so much today is that the sense of importance that people – both the scientists and the developers feel is attached to this particular work. And I think that – this conversation today has certainly made some of the challenges and the day-to-day processes that go into it a lot more visible. So I certainly hope that our readers will find a lot of value both in this conversation and in the rest of the technical articles that we have in our issue. So I wanted to say thank you, Rob. This has been a very interesting conversation, and I hope it was good from your side, too.
Oh, yeah. It's been great talking to you. Thanks.
Great. Well, thank you.